Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Connolly, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The matter before us at this time is in re the custody of SKTS, Sharon Oglesby versus Christopher Lee Stubrud. And counsel, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral argument this morning. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you would be aware that this matter is being recorded, so be sure when you're mentioning the child, you refer to the child not by the child's name, but by either the initials or just referring to the child as the child. With that being said, I think we can begin now with the appellant. Please introduce yourself and your client prior to beginning your oral arguments.
Thank you. Justices, counsel, I'm David Meyer, M-E-I-E-R. I represent Sharon Oglesby, the maternal aunt, and to SKTS, the minor child. If I may proceed, I would suggest the question for us this morning is, did Sharon Oglesby's complaint sufficiently plead an interested third party claim to defeat a motion to dismiss for a failure to state a claim? Ms. Oglesby is suggesting that it did and is asking you to reverse the district court judge's decision dismissing her petition and allow the needed evidentiary hearing to be conducted.
So is it your position the original petition was sufficient, or should we be focusing on the amended one in terms of satisfying the statutory requirements and alerting the district court as to, you know, what's going on in terms of the factors?
Yeah. So I think it is fair, Judge Justice, to consider that first petition light. Be very honest with you. I drafted it, and I wished to high heaven that I had done a more complete job. It was submitted to the court at the same time we submitted our motion for emergency relief, supported by a complete affidavit and, of course, a memorandum of law on the issue of third-party custody matters. Being said that it's light is a fact, I don't believe it denied the respondent an opportunity to fairly engage in the process and understand what we were doing. But it was amended, and in the amended petition, clearly all of the factors of 257C03 and referencing 07 were included. And I have no doubt that the respondent understood what his former sister-in-law was doing. Now, as we talk about the
Mr. Meyer, if I can just stop you briefly on that. The amended petition, the father claims that the amended petition's defective because it's not verified. That appears to me to be a statutory requirement. So would you address that?
The original petition, of course, was verified. The amended petition was not verified. What we have is the sworn affidavit of Sharon Oglesby submitted at the exact same time with all of the complete information, which we're pretty sure the judge in his making his rulings considered. The remedy, I would suggest, Justice, for this failure to not have a verification on the amended petition is not to dismiss. We can add that verification. I signed the petition as an officer of the court. We have the signed affidavit, and we have the verification of the same basic facts in the original. Do not believe that it is that the only remedy for the court would have been to dismiss. And I say that in part, Justice, because nowhere in either the original dismissal or in the dismissal affirmation, if you would, after the motion to reconsider, does a judge make any reference to that technicality? therefore,
so Mr. Meyer, you make a good point there. We don't see in the district court's decision the reasons for the dismissal.
Right.
Am I right about that? I couldn't see it.
I think the findings are pretty limited. What I would suggest you will find, and this is kind of my theory of what the judge was thinking, is the only finding that you see in the original dismissal, which that one was, I think, September 2nd, and also in the subsequent order on reconsideration, again, just stating is to be dismissed, was a judge's finding that he concluded respondent is SKTS's only remaining natural parent. And as such, he states, therefore, he's entitled to provide the legal and physical custody for the minor child. So he, what I think he was doing by making that kind of his only finding regarding this dismissal was just kind of jumping to the end of the game, so to speak, and saying, well, when you have a third party against a biological parent, the law here is pretty clear, and everyone acknowledges this, that a natural parent is the preferred parent, and it's the duty and responsibility of the interested third party to show that circumstances exist, primarily in the best interest of the child, that something different in this particular case should occur. So, yes, the findings. So
if I understand when you say that the district court made this finding, you know, that the father is entitled to legal and physical custody, you're certainly right. We see that. We don't really see the analysis. You're just kind of inferring that. I think that you argue that the binding case law for this district court's decision is the Lewis Miller case. And I saw that as well in respondent's brief. So it seems like you both agree on that, right?
Yes.
And when I read the Lewis Miller case, it suggests that there is some analysis that's required when a third party petition reaches the stage of either, you know, a dismissal because it fails to state a prima facie claim, or if it states a prima facie claim, second stage is it goes to an evidentiary hearing. So is my understanding right that as I read your brief, you're basically saying this petition amended and original and affidavits and all the other submissions, this petition stated a prima facie case for third party custody. Therefore, we're entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Is that your basic claim?
That's a basic claim. I thank you for saying that. And it's just,
and it's all based all really on Lewis Miller, right?
Yes, it is.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand is normally when a judge does not follow the law, you know, we can't see the basis for the judge's decision. We would normally remand it and say this is insufficient for appellate review. Now, you didn't make that argument. I assume you have a reason.
No.
So why don't you tell us what that reason is?
Because we would like to conduct an evidentiary hearing to ensure the safety of SKTS. Otherwise, it is very possible that we'll be right back here again, considering just the issue of whether or not an evidentiary hearing is appropriate and necessary. And again, we have 6 months of an inability to have any look at the arrangements and the things that are going on in the state of Michigan where respondent is now residing with the minor child.
I think what you're arguing is that, and I want to hear from respondent on this, is that it's important for a child to have permanency in custody decisions and that we typically do attempt to proceed with in those cases as swiftly as possible.
Well, exactly. And frankly, that was the reason that I asked for a reconsideration of the dismissal as opposed to asking for amended findings and a new trial. It was because I could get that possible review by the court much quicker and not delay this process if, as it turns out, he was just going to stay with a dismissal.
So we have been moving with this. And the district court did grant you a reconsideration. So I just want to ask about the first issue you raised in your brief. You emphasized quite a bit that you did not get an evidentiary hearing before the judge's first order dismissing the, well, that you didn't get any hearing, I should say, not evidentiary, any hearing before the judge's first dismissal order. I guess I'm struggling with why we would even need to review that, because you did get a hearing. I mean, you didn't get an evidentiary hearing, but you got a hearing. It was on reconsideration, and it appeared to me that at that point, the judge had everything before the court that you sought to put in front of the court to make this prima facie determination.
So we make that point because Rule 12, presumably the rule that the judge relied upon, does not allow ex parte decisions. And so the judge had made his decision. The purpose for the reconsideration, from our perspective, is to give him an opportunity before I make an appeal to the Court of Appeals, because it's very settled that you would prefer we try once with the trial court judge and to show them what we think is the law. So I did that because I think that's the right thing to do. And I did it in the most timely, efficient manner as possible.
And I understand you're pointing out some procedural errors that the district court made, but the final order of the district court, the one in October 29th, I think, that was entered after a hearing. So I guess I don't see the need to go to the judge's first order. And maybe I'm missing something, and you should explain it to me.
No, I mean, the two orders really are identical in that they don't give any analysis of the judge's thinking and process. It's just a dismissal, not even stating a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. That was his call. That's what he believed. My suggestion is he just was looking to the end game. But today, as you look at this de novo, and with the understanding that we give credence to pleadings for petitioners, we accept as true, and we ask, was the respondent fairly able to understand and be prepared for what was coming? He was. The allegation of abandonment, a four-year absence, wasn't really denied at all. It was tried to be explained away, but not denied. That's the heart and soul of 257C 01 and following. And so that's there. And Sharon Oglesby is trying to ensure that SKTS is in a safe place. If at the end of the discussion with the court, should you grant an evidentiary hearing or remand it for an evidentiary hearing, the court can go either way at that point, but he will have all of the evidence after discovery, which is necessary, I believe, in this case, because there's been no explanation of the 4 years. All we have is an argument that, well, mother made up lies and got an OFP and I've been denied access, when you saw in the actual pleadings that the OFP that kind of started all this in 2016 was not allegations by mother. They were allegations by a third party who called the police after hearing some terroristic threats from the respondent. And then Judge Jude properly in that OFP gave the respondent an opportunity to continue to have contact with his son through the parenting consultant, with whom there's evidence respondent talked to. It's just she said, we've got to get some medical records to see how that civil commitment in Wisconsin has played out and is concluded. And with that, he's done. And he walked away. So the focus, I believe, that we have is, was the respondent able to understand what was coming so he can prepare? I think he was. I wish I had drafted a more complete petition. That's on me. I don't think this child, the minor child, or the maternal family should be locked out of seeking an evidentiary hearing. If it goes the way of father, that's a win for everybody, because the facts will be there. We just hadn't had any opportunity, Judge, to do any discovery at that quick motion for reconsideration. That we didn't do that. And therefore, we're requesting that you remand back for an evidentiary hearing. And one of the things that's kind of critical on that is, since September, when Sharon Oglesby returned or made available SKTS to the respondent, there's been zero contact, zero. So the family has no knowledge of what's going on, not a letter, not a phone call, not a Skype, not a school report, not a medical report, zero, no contact. So he has effectively ostracized his SKTS's entire mother's side of the family. And that is a cause for concern. So respectfully. So,
Mr. Meyer, I just want to clarify. Did you have a request for visitation as part of this third party petition in addition to actual custody?
Yeah, we did. Okay. And the court acknowledged it would be a great idea and encouraged the respondent to provide that, but then acknowledged that under our present statute, other than grandparents, there are some specific grandparent rights. Other family members do not have a specific path to access. And he acknowledged that and said, it would make sense, do what you need to do. And there's been nothing. I appreciate the questions. If there are any others, I'd be glad to respond. Otherwise, thank you for the opportunity.
The respondent may proceed at this time.
Thank you, Your Honors. John Jerebeck, representing Mr. Christopher Stuber, the biological father. May it please the court and counsel. The trial court here had very broad discretion in resolving disputes pertaining to custody and parenting time. Here, Judge Jude did not commit clear error with regard to dismissal of the first petition without an evidentiary hearing.
Can I ask you, with regard to the first, what about the second one?
He also did not commit clear error. There was talk about the findings, and we all hope every judge has perfect findings in every case for them to be reviewed. The fact of the matter is it's not simply about notice to the respondent here. The fact of the matter is, under law, the petitions, both the petition and amended petition, failed to meet the requirements to establish that the aunt could be either a de facto custodian under 257C or an interested third party under 257C.
Well, could I ask you this? I mean, do we agree that the law is that the judge, in determining whether there should be an evidentiary hearing, has to assume that the facts as stated in the petition, that they are true?
The judge has to determine the facts as stated in the petition are true. However, the judge may also examine information that explains information in that petition. And so Boland versus Murtha allows that to be done. That being said, I mean, the real key to this case, Lewis Miller versus Ross sets a framework, but the Otacon case, the Otacon versus Kayachith case, is the case that truly looks at what the issue is here. And the fact of the matter is not everybody is allowed to petition. You need to establish a substantial relationship. In the Kayachith case, it was brought by writ in front of this court.
And counsel, I just want to stop you for a second. You are emphasizing an issue a little differently than you did in your brief. You're starting with the defect in the aunt's petition being that she did not allege a substantial relationship with the child. Am I understanding you right?
That is correct. She did not.
Okay, because it seems to me when I listen to the aunt's argument, the emphasis in response to your claims was that a failure to allege, you have claimed the aunt failed to allege abandonment. Is that still your position?
Again, abandonment under 260C has some presumptions with regard to abandonment, and they are pieces where an individual does not comply with a court order. Here, there was not a court order for parenting time. It's interesting that Mr. Meyer says that, you know, what's going on now is father.
Wait a second. Are you saying that under the OFP that the father could not obtain parenting time?
Father could bring an action to obtain parenting time. And
well, there were provisions for parenting time, weren't there?
There were not provisions for parenting time here, but there was a possibility of him bringing a motion, because under the order for protection, you do have the ability to move forward with a request for parenting time. And he did not move forward with a request.
So you're now, I mean, and I understand this is in father's affidavit. I mean, I've read the file and the father submitted some detailed affidavits explaining this position. It sounds to me like you're completely contradicting the facts and the evidence that has been offered by the aunt on this point. And so because it's a complete contradiction, you're saying no parenting time allowed under the OFP unless father takes steps. Aunt says, no, the OFP did allow parenting time and father failed to pursue it. That sounds like a need for an evidentiary hearing under Lewis Miller. So would you address that, please?
Okay. Number one, with regard to an order for parenting time that has specifics as to what that parenting time is going to look like, there would be an agreement. That is not what we had here, an order with regard to specifics with regard to parenting time. What we had is the potential that any issue be go over to it, not the court, but another individual, a parenting consultant, and that parenting consultant would then have authority. That is not a court order with regard to parenting time that somebody is not following. That being said, there was a four-year period of time without contact. And that is recognized and admitted. There is justification, but if that was the only issue, I certainly could see why the court would examine and say, we need an evidentiary hearing just to go through whether that abandonment piece occurred. If this court finds abandonment here, if this court were to determine that there was abandonment and that the trial court erred, there still is an issue with substantial relationship. You cannot move
before forward. You go to the substantial relationship point. Sure. I just want to, you know, be clear. So our court doesn't make findings of fact. We're not going to find abandonment. And Lewis Miller would not suggest that we should do that. I think you do agree, right? Lewis Miller sets up the legal framework for this petition.
Lewis Miller sets up the legal framework. Okay. Lewis Miller looks at Niece Peterson, which, you know, essentially based it on what we do with regard to custody modification. And so it sets up the framework where the person petitioning has to establish a prima facie case, and the other individual is allowed to respond and provide context. And there is a disagreement because we think the explanation with regard to what happened over the 4 years is providing context about what occurred, while the aunt clearly believes there is a difference of factual opinion. There wasn't a difference with regard to facts. It was explaining the context of the 4 year time period.
So going to your argument about substantial relationship, as I read it in your brief, you are not arguing that that is a statutory requirement. You are arguing that that falls, obviously the statute does require in a third party custody petition that the relationship be laid out. And we're all familiar with that. But your use of that word substantial relationship has come up in case law, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so point out clearly to me which cases exactly you rely on for that.
Okay, we're relying on In Re Kayachet. And that's 683 Northwest 2nd, 325, 328.
No, we have the site in your brief. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't overlooking anything. I wasn't sure if you were citing anything new or different.
Sure. And the Kayachev case by this court recognized that failure to allege a substantial relationship in the petition itself justifies dismissal. And that's precisely what this court did based upon a writ. There is a mechanism under law, under 260C.141, there is a mechanism that allows people who are concerned and do not have substantial relationships with a child, that individual could bring essentially a CHIPS action, a Child in Need of Protection or Services action. If you do not have the substantial relationship, you cannot move forward. And here there was not a substantial relationship. When you look at the facts, even set forth by the aunt, having contact over the past 4 years, it looked like two times. She said up to twice a year. And the Kaichith case separates out what is a non-existent or nominal relationship as opposed to what is a substantial relationship. And all of this goes back to essentially modification of the statute. The statute formerly was, 518.156, which is cited by appellant in their brief, that was superseded a few years after the Troxell case, Troxell versus Granville, because the Troxell case recognized we need heightened standards when we are essentially examining somebody's liberty interest under the due process clause. And this heightened standard exists. I believe the judge, going back to a point made earlier, I think the judge first was looking at the Holman case, the 1959 Minnesota Supreme Court decision.
I'm sorry, you're saying the judge in Kiasid?
Apologize. Yeah. Judge Jude here was...
I don't see any analysis by Judge Jude. So how would we know that?
Well, Judge Jude, as counsel indicated, Judge Jude at the end essentially says the father has this right.
Wait a second. So you must be relying on something the court said to you. We don't have a transcript of those comments or remarks.
Nope, we do not have a transcript of the comments.
I don't understand how that's in front of us.
Counsel for appellant made it clear that there's only one finding pertaining to why father should essentially have custody. What I am indicating is father's natural right to have custody is established by the Holman case. When a parent passes away, the other parent has an automatic immediate right to custody.
So you are clearly inferring that from the one line in the judge's order, correct?
I am inferring
it. Yeah, I mean, I you heard my earlier question. This is a case where it's very difficult for the court to review. We have no findings or analysis by the district court, even though Lewis Miller, which you agree controls, suggests that, in fact, yes, we do need some specific analysis by the district court.
And I, again, would hope that all determinations were very clear with all findings. However,
but I don't think I'm being overly picky here, counsel. I'm just asking for the court to follow Lewis Miller, right? And you say that's what the district court should have done. You specifically make the long abandonment argument you made, and that there is no given context, there was no abandonment. You make this lengthy argument about how the aunt has a nominal, not a substantial relationship, but you're making that all up based on your view. There's nothing in the district court order that would let me adopt that analysis as an appellate judge where I make no findings.
Yeah, the question would be, did the court err with regard to not making those findings.
And in fact, did the district court fail to follow proper procedure?
And the piece with regard to that is the burden is on the individual submitting the petition. And again, when you look at the Troxell case, when you look at the ramifications from the Troxell case, when you look at the modification away from 518.156 to 257C, all of that occurs and places the burden on the person, the non-parent, seeking custody to establish a basis under law. And so they not only have to establish the basis under the statute and go through every one of the 257C
criteria. Mr. Jarabek, what is your best argument that Mr. Meyer did not do that, did not establish a basis to overcome Troxell, which assumes that, you know, the surviving parent has sole custody? What's your best argument that he did not do that in either his petition or amended petition?
In the original petition, it essentially states best interest in the petition itself. It does not go through the factors in the petition itself. When we look at the amended petition removes 518.156 and looks exactly like the original petition. So in the petition itself, there wasn't. And the 35W Bridge case says you are limited to the facts set forth in your petition. The petition here is important, and there's a heightened standard with regard to the petition itself. 257.03 subdivision 8 recognizes, and there was the argument regarding liberal pleadings, 257C.03 subdivision 8 recognizes here, because we're dealing with a fundamental interest, if a party fails to meet the requirements under 257C, the petition shall be dismissed by the district court. It is mandatory. And the burden is on the petitioner.
Thank you. Any other questions? Hearing none, the appellant may proceed with his rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice. Very briefly, two points made through the questions and Mr. Jarabek's comments. First, regarding abandonment. Secondly, regarding the relationship issue. On abandonment, that is a factual dispute. I do believe respondent has the right to give some context to the consideration of abandonment, but in so doing, he has highlighted the fact that there is substantial disagreement as to what went on. And the questions regarding what the actual 2016 order for protection did regarding parenting time was very telling and very important. The order itself said he shall be entitled to parenting time as negotiated through the parenting consultant, which it's also important to point out that a parenting consultant is not something a judge can thrust upon parties absent their consent. The parties at that hearing consented to the use of a parenting consultant to do some of the deep background necessary regarding the mental state of the respondent following the civil commitment in Wisconsin. So that just emphasizes, I believe, the need for an evidentiary hearing. Secondly, on the relationship component, I also agree with counsel that the Kayasich case does have something to tell us about having alleged some significant relationship. But in that case, which I believe is to be distinguished, it was admitted by the interested third party, that they really had no contact with the children prior to the point where the judge provided them temporary access to the kids. The second point I think is very relevant on this issue is the judge did not make all of the findings regarding this relationship at the very onset of the case in that matter, as Judge Jew did here in the case involving the minor child. Instead, they had gone down the road. There had been some hearings. There had been some orders from the court regarding parenting time that included these parents. It's just months down the road of that litigation, the court concluded that because the third party's argument was they had a significant relationship with the child that started after the petition was filed. And that's just not the case here. Sharon Oglesby was named the guardian in an estate plan 10 years ago. She's had weekly contact, yearly visits being out of state for weeks at a time, oftentimes. And that's detailed significantly in the affidavits that apparently the judge chose to rely upon. So I believe that it is our burden. And I wish that the petition would have been stronger. I do believe the amended petition absolutely takes into consideration the specific factors enumerated in 257C, 03 and 07. And of that, I have no doubt. So we're talking about a young child, now 12, going on 13, and we are just asking for the right to ensure his safety. There is no harm to the child for that, obviously. And it is something that the family feels a very strong and important need to do. So thank you for your consideration. I will certainly respond to any questions.
All right. I'm not hearing any questions. This matter is concluded. Thank you, counsel, for your briefing and arguments in this matter. We will take it under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory period of time. And